This is Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service. Media Network, a weekly review of what's happening in the international communications business, hosted by Diana Janssen and Jonathan Marks.
Hello, ladies, gentlemen, tape recorders and pirate radio stations. This show has returned safely from South Africa, and spring is bursting forth at our broadcast centre here in Hilversum.
And things are quite turbulent at the moment, what with major networks like the BBC making several million-pound investments in creating 8 separate streams for world service in English.
As well as firing several hundred consultants and middle managers, as the new reign of Director General Greg Dyke takes a foothold.
Here in Holland, the internet business has been going through some shake-ups too, not only because of the effects of the ruling in the US against Microsoft, but a fiasco concerning the tumbling share price of the internet provider World Online. They're based here in Holland, but active in many European countries and also South Africa. Quite a lot of people have lost a lot of money recently. The confidence was further shaken with a revelation that founder Nina Brink sold a lot of her shares just before the company went public.
We've also had quite a few emails reacting to our comments on this show that we believe digital audio broadcasting, or DAB, to be so seriously in trouble that it will probably have to be relaunched in a different form. With less than 10,000 receivers in use across the entire continent and no portable set yet on the horizon, this 10-year-old technology needs a rapid rethink. David Aldrich in Northampton agrees with our correspondent Bob Tomolsky that DAB lacks a focused publicity campaign and no one will get excited about an $800 radio.
More letters concentrating on radio's content coming up, but first we'll disappear into the receiver lab.
Time now for Media Network's Equipment Laboratory. What's hot and what's not.
And today we focus on a Japanese tabletop receiver.
The ICOM ICR-75 first appeared in North America towards the end of last year. Judging from magazine advertisements, ICOM in Europe are now making an effort to launch the set onto the European market. Tom Sundstrom has compiled an in-depth review for us on the Media Network website. And for this radio edition, we're going to pick some of the major highlights.
First, we're talking about a tabletop receiver for the serious listener. At a price of £610 sterling in the UK, $780 in Canada, or $1,775 in Australia, that's before the options have been selected. You're not going to be interested in such a set unless you take the hobby of digging weak stations out of the noise quite seriously.
ICOM has a solid reputation in the amateur radio community as a supplier of transceivers. And for many shortwave listeners, the durable ICOM ICR-71A won many fans for being a workhorse receiver from the mid-80s until it disappeared from dealer shelves in the mid-1990s. The factory-supplied filters were of superior quality, but some users grumbled about muffled audio quality. The ICR-72 that replaced it was not as robust a receiver as the 71A, but it also had its share of followers.
So at the start of last year, ICOM had a gap in its product lineup, for they had no tabletop communications receiver. Kenwood and Yaesu had also recently discontinued their general coverage tabletops, and these two firms apparently have no intention of returning to the listener market.
Towards the end of 1999, ICOM filled the vacancy with the introduction of the ICR-75 communications receiver. The price we just mentioned is less than its predecessors and less than the nearest competitor on the North American market, namely the Drake R8 series receiver. We've received questions to media@rnw.nl as to how the ICR-75 stacks up against the Drake R8B and the older ICOMs like the R71A. So we bought a receiver off the shelf, fitted out with all the options such as extra filters and computer control software.
Time to open the box. Inside are an AC power supply, the receiver and a 44-page instruction manual. Don't lose those instructions, because none of the optional accessories we bought contained any instructions at all. They all refer to what turns out to be a comprehensive and logical guide to the ICR-75.
In most areas of the world, the receiver covers from 30 kHz to 60 MHz. In Asia, the coverage stops 1 Hz short of 30 MHz. On sets sold in some countries like Denmark and Australia, certain chunks of the bands are missing above 30 MHz. In this solar maximum period, frequencies in the range of 50 to 54 megahertz contain European television audio and are regularly getting across the Atlantic. For most users, though, the shortwave portion is going to be the most important.
The ICR75 comes with three filters, a narrow 2.1 kHz filter for DXing and single sideband reception, plus wider ones at 6 and 12 kHz respectively for broadcast listening under good conditions. The connections on the rear of the receiver are intuitive, but there are some strange configurations. The recorder remote control jack turns out to be a mini plug, unlike the usual terminals or lug strips found on other receivers.
You can operate the receiver using a personal computer if you want, allowing easier use and management of the memories.
And so to the set itself. The front panel is dominated by a large yellowish backlit liquid crystal display that shows the frequency down to the nearest 10 hertz in large digits. A linear signal strength meter runs along the bottom, and indicators such as mode, memory, noise blanker, and the selected tuning step appear around the frequency readout.
Tuning is either via a large tuning knob, or you can tab in the frequency directly onto a keypad. Although the software is a bit clumsy at first, it's very versatile. So you can scan the bands in steps of 100 kHz at a time, or crawl through the interesting bits at intervals of 10 Hz. There are six small buttons placed horizontally along the very bottom of the front panel. They are there to control things like the preamplifier, attenuator, noise reduction, or the automatic notch filter. Access to these is a bit awkward, unless the adjustable stand is used to tilt up the receiver towards you. We know, though, that this set tends to have a lot of mechanical controls rather than a nested software menu seen on sets like the AOR AR7030. Neither is better. It's just a matter of personal taste.
Until the end of March, ICOM's been running a promotion, at least in the United States, offering a free circuit board containing digital signal processing circuitry. Normally, this accessory board costs $160. We found it quite effective in notching out continuous whistles or heterodynes, both in single sideband, and we also note instances on weaker signals where the noise reduction works to some degree on AM, despite comments to the contrary in the manual.
You need to read the 7 pages in the manual to make full use of the 99 memory channels on the ICR75. It's a bit like programming a cell phone, because you can label memories if you want the names of favourite stations.
For $55, ICOM offers a voice synthesizer to assist blind users of the radio. A woman's voice announces the signal strength, frequency, mode and time in English or Japanese. But there's no way to adjust the volume of the voice, so the announcement is sometimes buried in received signal audio. You can timestamp tape recordings, but not if you're not in front of the receiver. In terms of performance, the set turns out to have excellent sensitivity. And as far as selectivity is concerned, the ability to pick out the station you want from the rest, we give the set a fair to good rating. The filters are fine for the price range. Our main criticism is that there's virtually no difference between synchronous AM and standard AM reception. That's because the synchronous mode includes both sidebands. There's no option to choose the lower or upper sideband. The much cheaper low HF150, for instance, has a synchronous mode too, which is far superior. Fortunately, the ICOM's SSB reception is very stable, so in crowded band conditions, single sideband's the best way to go.
Well, those are some of the highlights. Lots more detail in the report we've published on our website at www.rnw.nl. The bottom line is that the ICOM ICR75 gets a 4 out of 5 star rating from us. It's better than the low HF150 or the discontinued Yaesu FRG100. But the set is not as good as the Drake R8B, the NRD545 from JRC, or the AOR 7030 Plus. But then these are 30 to 50% more expensive than the ICOM ICR75. Well, so much for receivers, now to internet news.
Now, in the shortwave programs forum that's currently running on the internet, there's been an interesting discussion going on as to why some broadcasts from foreign countries are compelling listening, and others seem to be there just to keep the transmitter warm. Clearly, many of those in the group are fed up with the predictability of formatted radio in the United States. Some argue it might spread much further than that, thanks to automation. As part of the discussion, contributors refer to a new book that has just appeared in the US by a researcher, Susan Douglas. It's called Listening In, Radio and the American Imagination, from Amos and Andy and Edward R. Murrow to Wolfman Jack and Howard Stern. The same author recently published an article to promote the book that appeared in several US newspapers back in December.
Most of us know that feeling, driving alone at night on a road or highway, surrounded by darkness and listening to the radio. Or we share that delicious, almost primal memory of lying in bed, sometimes with the covers just barely over our heads, listening intently to a world beyond our windows. Before so many of us installed tape decks and CD players in our cars or trucks, it was the voices and music on the radio that provided that lifeline we needed, pulling us out of the solitary darkness. In bed, the sound of a bat cracking against a ball, or the music of, say, Sam Cooke, transported us to places we imagined to be more vibrant, less fettered, than our own boring, constricted little universes. There we were, alone, yet through this device, we were tied by the most gossamer connections to an imagined community of people we sensed loved the same music or ball club that we did, and to an announcer or disc jockey who often spoke to us in the most intimate, confidential, and inclusive tones. Back before the rise of FM and the constant expectation of clear stereophonic sound, we tuned in at night and heard 50,000-watt AM stations several states away. We vaulted over regional boundaries, yet felt that we were part of a community, even if only of radio listeners, bigger than ourselves.
Isn't that beautiful? I think Susan Douglas has really caught the emotion of the days of long-distance medium-wave listening in the US. In fact, anywhere for that matter.
John Figliozzi in New York added the following comment to the shortwave news group.
While tuning around on AM with that little Riviera 6-transistor radio, I came to learn that there was a place where radio was respected as a craft and art form in itself, instead of just a cash machine disguised as a jukebox. That place was Canada, and the station I heard was CBL in Toronto. I heard my first radio play, serious, intelligent drama, and my first serialized book readings, intelligent conversation, creative humor, and satire. The station just sounded different, much different than anything else I was hearing on medium wave. With the baseball, basketball, and hockey games, Dan Ingram and Cousin Brucey on WABC, and that different stuff from Canada, for a brief, shining period, there was real programming diversity on AM. Then came the rise of FM and my first two-band radio. WNEW-FM introduced me to progressive rock, with quieter, I learned later, mostly stone, disc jockeys. Rather than playing the top 20 45s over and over and over again, these guys got creative with the music, selecting songs thematically and weaving a set the way a good musician might. I also got my first taste of the educational band. Station WAMC of the Albany Medical College had someone named Gene Shepherd who, just before the station sign-off at 11 p.m., wove fantastic tales through a meandering one-hour dialogue. It always, just in the nick of time, tied up all the loose ends as the theme music was about to end. As AM became increasingly safe, and worse, wholly predictable, FM became my refuge. Now FM is suffering AM's fate. Today my refuge is shortwave, and sometimes the internet. Maybe I'm just getting too hard to please, but it seems to me almost everyone, everywhere around the world, is starting to sound just like AM and FM. Of course, there are exceptions, and we all know what and who they are. But I wonder if they will, in the end, be able to resist the huge and ever-growing commercial compulsion that forces all players to chase the biggest audience or the most readily obtained dollar in order to just survive.
That comment reminds me of a beautiful montage at the opening of the Radio Documentary Festival in Amsterdam a couple of years ago. It's a great collection of reasons why radio is so powerful.
They say the last sense to go before we die is sound, is hearing. So, at a very basic level, sound is a very powerful medium.
When you're listening, you're creating pictures in your mind's eye.
Specific quality of sound is that it is around you. It's room. Sound is room, and pictures are flat?
Well, I like to manipulate people's feelings. And to do that, I use sound, because sound moves the feelings of people much more than pictures. That's why I like radio.
Well, the thing called TV, of course, has the enormous advantage of pictures, which immediately communicate certain situations. But TV cannot deal with ideas, and TV is also very limiting. And I think the power of sound lies in the fact that it addresses that huge screen, that visual screen that we all have in our minds, and makes us create pictures and join in.
Well, television is a strong friend or enemy. It takes over your house. It holds you in its grip. But I think when it releases you, you have nothing special. In fact, I always go to bed rather exhausted after trying to watch television. The power of sound is that it leaves you free to explore your thoughts, your ideas, and it brings into your head images that are entirely personal and yet maybe universal too. You can't tell that. So television shuts me off, radio draws me in.
Beautiful. Bob Tomolsky is back on the radio now. We're following up on a question from Martin Longsdale in Albany, New York, and Catherine Burkett of Chester in the UK. Both ask about a term they have seen mentioned in newspapers, namely Bluetooth. Catherine says she understands it has something to do with miniature transmitters, and the hype indicates it's supposedly going to revolutionize our lives as 2000 really gets a hold. Now, Bob, perhaps you can explain further.
Well, there's a trend called home networking, which is a rather complicated term for using your computer or any other device anywhere in the house. Imagine a computer in one room that transmits via radio to, if you like, a terminal that you carry around a bit like a laptop. The idea is that you would have your main computer connected to a laptop using a system known as Bluetooth, which is like a little miniature chipset which transmits data very, very quickly. For example, you might have a mini disc player in your bedroom connected to your hi-fi system downstairs in another room, so the audio would be transmitted around the house using radio. In fact, Sony was showing the idea of having one of their memory sticks, which is a device used in camcorders, still video, and their very latest digital audio Walkman, and transmitting audio from this memory stick, or indeed photos from a camcorder, to any PC in the house or any other product in the house equipped with the same Bluetooth chip.
Now, Sony call this personal broadcasting, but what sort of range do you have?
Well, it is limited. I mean, they claim about 100 metres, which I find astonishing. I think more likely it will go through a wall from one room to another room. That's fine. But, you know, it's not what I call great distance broadcasting. I think if you've got a house and you wanted to transmit a picture from your camcorder in your garden to your computer in your bedroom, I think that's when it's going to come unstuck.
But we've already got wireless headphones. I mean, is this the same idea?
It's a similar idea, but it moves it a stage further in that it transmits data very, very quickly. So the idea is, I think the idea they really want to do is be able to transmit full bandwidth video using this sort of system. But I think that Bluetooth has limitations, which is perhaps going to prevent that. But we're going to see it used in all sorts of very odd ways. For example, telephone manufacturers are saying that you could have the mobile phone in your pocket and the headset and earpiece would be a miniature device which is not connected via a cable. So you'd have a personal Bluetooth system carried, you know, on your body. That's the thing that's coming. I was told to look out for the new phones which use this.
But can your neighbours then sort of tune in to what you're doing next door?
No, because it's encoded and it's a special code related to the products that you're using. But of course, the question is begged, if your neighbour has got exactly the same product, maybe they will be able to tune in. What worries me is that, you know, having all these little miniature RF transmitters inside consumer electronics products might well cause interference. I'm told that that's not the case because it's all operating at around 2 gigahertz, but you know what it is with RF. It has a nasty habit of getting in everywhere, so time will tell.
Thanks, Bob. And if anyone doubts that we're going to really go mobile in the first decade of the new century, remember that by 2004, there will be more than 500 million mobile phones on the planet. And if you believe some of the latest figures from Forrester Research, more than 219 million people, or one-third of the European population, will access internet services using mobile phones by 2003. Nearly 120 million Europeans already use mobile phones, and they exchange more than 2 billion SMS text messages each month. And that works out to around 200,000 a day in Holland alone.
Of course, the trick with a phone is that the technology inside the device knows where you are, and so information such as traffic information or news can be personalised in the same way that some internet sites now send you cookies. But at present, the industry is cautious about trying to broadcast messages such as commercials. Whilst it's perfectly possible for a sponsor to send a message to, let's say, all the people with a mobile phone in the Amsterdam football stadium during a football match, the irritation factor could well outweigh the benefits.
Peter Townsend in Pretoria, South Africa, sent us an email to say he enjoyed our entire South Africa week here on Radio Netherlands, including the Media Network special from Cape Town.
Well, Peter, there'll be more next week when Diana will be presenting a follow-up feature in which we theorise that community radio in Africa is going to develop in a completely different direction than originally planned.
Peter also downloaded our webcast special back on March 11th. During the show, we spoke with our correspondent Brian Clark in Auckland, New Zealand, who explained he was going to make a trip into the countryside to do some serious medium-wave listening.
Peter assumes correctly that Brian's returned safely. He's on the line now. Brian, how did it go?
Oh, it went very well indeed, Jonathan. Exceeded our expectations in every sense.
So where did you go?
I went to Oamaru in the South Island of New Zealand, about 100 kilometres north of the city of Dunedin on the east coast of the South Island. At that location, Paul Ormandy, who's one of the best-known New Zealand DXs, has a location. It's out in the country. We have access to a number of very long antenna wires permanently erected across the farmland there. A special feature of the site is also the lack of electricity. We're at least a kilometre from the nearest power supply.
So you use batteries, do you?
Yes, completely battery-operated. Gas for cooking. Solar panels provide a little bit of energy, but essentially we're using 12-volt batteries.
And what sort of antennas do you use?
Good number of antennas. I use two in particular. One 425 metres length, aimed at Bolivia in South America, and the other 310 metres long, aimed at Florida in the United States. The length of these wires makes them very directional along the length, and the antennas are earthed through a resistor at the remote end, which makes them unidirectional rather than bidirectional. And these are called beverage antennas, and the length puts us into wavelengths of 300 to 400 metres, which obviously our target is the medium wave or AM broadcast band, and the direction of the antennas. Our target on the de-expedition was medium wave stations in both North and South America.
Now, we keep telling people that an antenna is extremely important in these sort of expeditions, and indeed with antennas of, you know, 425 metres long, that's going to pick up a lot of signal. The other thing, of course, is the receiver itself. What sort of receiver are you using there?
Well, this was my first time on a de-expedition with my new receiver, which is an AOR 7030 Plus, and this is the first time I've used it on battery supply.
What's so special about this receiver compared to other sets, let's say, you know, Drake R8 or other popular sets like the ICOM ICR75, which we'll review today?
My experience with those other receivers is that they draw quite a heavy current. The advantages of the AOR 7030 Plus for me were the availability of memories, good number of filters. I think it's the versatility of the receiver that really means you can dig a signal out of the adjacent interference. You can scan through the frequencies that you're targeting very quickly. It's a receiver that I'll be attempting to use in a lot of DX expeditions in the future.
Okay, so having done all this, what do you actually hear? I mean, of course, what you're going to present to us now is something that is not something you're going to be able to pick up on ordinary transistor radio in downtown Auckland, but nevertheless, let's hear what why you made the effort.
Okay, well, we covered all of North and South America, from Canada right through both West and East Coast United States, and through the Caribbean, right down to Argentina, Chile, and Brazil, which was particularly pleasing. So I've got here a series of extracts from some of the stations heard, and just hoping that we can capture some of the excitement of the expedition. Well, the first one is a signal that's relatively straightforward, but it's KNX in Los Angeles, California. This is on 1070 AM. The point about this one is there is a New Zealand station 1 kilohertz away on 1071, but with the passband tuning on the receiver, it is possible to minimise the interference. So this is 1070, avoiding interference from a local station on 1071.
That's not bad, bearing in mind the distance. Now, why is it so important to have multiple antennas on a de-expedition, though?
Well, the signals are coming from different directions, and it is possible through the antenna to optimise reception from one part of the world over another. And when the frequency, particularly on medium wave, is occupied by potentially a large number of stations, it is possible to optimise one station over another. Now, in this next clip, 1620 kilohertz, part of the expanded medium wave band, we'll start first of all on the South American antenna, and it's a religious station in Argentina, in Spanish, Radio Tropical.
Right, that's coming through fairly well. And now you switch the antenna.
Yes, we switch to the North American antenna, and immediately up comes KAZP in Omaha, Nebraska, with a sports program.
ESPN Radio, my name is Bob Valvano, coming to you live from the ESPN.
The change to KAZP is quite obvious there. What else did you hear? Anything from the East Coast?
Yes, we do have some fortune from the East Coast of the United States, from here in the South Pacific. Here's how KYW News Radio in Philadelphia came through. The frequency is 1060 kilohertz.
And what time are these recordings being made?
Generally between 06 and 1000 UTC. This is our early evening period. Darkness path across the Pacific Ocean, quite respectable hours really, from approach of sunset right through to local midnight.
Now, of course, you're heading towards the winter DX season. Are there some easy ones that people can try for, bearing in mind not everybody has these, 400-metre-long antennas?
Yes, well, I think the best signal from South America in recent years has tended to be on 1470 kilohertz. This is in Lima, Peru. And on this next clip, we hear an identification for CPN Radio.
That's not bad indeed. Well, thanks to Brian in Auckland, and he'll be back with shortwave tips in 7 days.
And last but not least, today, Mike Bird has the space weather review and forecast for us. What's it been like over the last 7 days, Mike?
Well, Diana, solar activity ranged between low and high levels. We experienced 11 solar flares, but all of them produced low to medium strength shortwave fadeouts on the daylight side of the Earth. The solar flux averaged out to 214 and equals an effective sunspot number of 165, and that is exactly the same as the previous week's figure. The geomagnetic field ranged between unsettled and active thresholds. The most disturbed days were on Friday, Saturday and Sunday. The ionosphere became particularly depressed on Friday due to the geomagnetic disturbance on the same day. And in Europe and North America, maximum usable frequencies dropped by 35%. Now to the forecast for the next 7 days. IPS Radio and Space Services expect solar activity will continue at low to moderate levels. Flares and shortwave fadeouts continue to be a distinct possibility. The geomagnetic field is expected to become disturbed on Friday and Saturday due to another coronal hole on the sun. Hopefully from Sunday, conditions will quiet.
Thanks, Mike. And with that warning, we shut the books for now.
We both wish you a pleasant weekend.
Bye for now.